What time do they close? Turn the lights out here. I'm a recovered drunk and a member of the Friday Night Men's Keep It Simple group. And it's a privilege for me to be here sober tonight. Name is Paul. A.K.A. Hey You. All right. I used to love to do this, but now I get a little bit nervous. But I'll do the best I can. I'm going to do the very best. My story hasn't changed since I came to AA. It's three parts: the way it was, what happened, and the way it's. Way it is now. I came from a good family, a loving family. I'm the oldest of four. I got a brother and two sisters. And it's kind of funny because it was a loving family. But when I got in AA, it seemed you start picking up the lingo and saying stuff without even thinking about it. And I happened to say one time in a group that I was from a dysfunctional family. My sponsor grabbed me outside and he said, "Is anybody else in your family an alcoholic?" And I said, "No." He says, "You're the one that's dysfunctional." So, I never forgot. We went to Catholic school, went to church on Sunday, and did all the good things. I had high ambitions about what I wanted to do when I grew up. I couldn't wait to grow up. Very impatient about that. I wanted to skip a grade when I was in grade school because I wanted to get it over with quicker. I had told my family that I never wanted to drink, not ever. And the reason for that is I had two uncles that I really loved, and, well, two or three of them. And they were alcoholics and had a lot of difficulty when they drank. And to me, it just seemed to be a terrible and powerful waste of time and energy and talent. And I couldn't understand why they did that. My family was engaged in procurement and distribution of alcoholic beverages during Prohibition in Detroit. All they had to do was go across the river to Windsor, Ontario, where Hiram Walker was working 24 hours a day to make more whiskey than anybody could drink. And so I had one uncle that had the fastest speedboat on the Detroit River, and his business card said that he was an importer of ginger ale. We had people in our family that were delivering whiskey in suitcases to vice presidents in the General Motors building, and I had a couple uncles that were driving beer trucks. People were making bathtub gin. I mean, there was a lot of activity centered around drinking, which had been made illegal by the government. And they had places where you could go and drink, and they were instead of bars, they because they were undercover, they were called blind pigs or speakeasies. And my father was a bartender in one of those places, and then when prohibition was lifted, he was a bartender and manager of one of the biggest nightclubs in the city, Detroit. He stayed a bartender all his life, and he drank very heavily, I thought. And I asked him about it before. He said, "Well, that was part of the job, or part of went with the territory of being in that business." And we never missed a meal. We never missed having new clothes to go to start school with in the fall. Just everything was normal. My father was not an alcoholic, and we never got our lights shut off. The bills were always paid, and like I said, it was all very normal. And I was never going to drink, because I saw what happened to my uncles, and I maintained that until I got into high school. I think it was my third year of high school. I changed schools, and I got on a football team, and these guys drank like college fraternity guys, you know. They invited me to go to this party, and I'd already had a couple beers with them, and that didn't turn out so good. I got sick, and I said I'd never do that again, and I kept my promise on that for at least 2 weeks, I think, you know. And this guy called me up, and he said, "Listen, we got a big party to go to, big party, biggest in the season, and you got to line your stomach." And I said, why do I have to line my... He says, "So you can drink more and not get drunk." I said, "How do I line my stomach?" He says, you've got to eat a quarter pound stick of butter. These guys were serious about drinking. So I did what they told me. He said, "It'll help you not to get sick and throw up as much either, you know." So that's how my drinking career started. And we drank whenever we got the chance, weekends. And when I graduated high school, I decided to go to college, University of Detroit. I signed up for night school and taking business classes to get a degree. Well, I wanted to go to law school, but I decided to start in the business school, and that worked out good for me, because I was going 3 and 4 nights a week, and my buddies that graduated high school wanted me to come drink, and I said, "I got to go to school," and so that probably saved my skin a little bit for a period of time. However, and I went 5 years in a row to night school, and I was really serious about wanting to graduate. And I was going to just take 80 hours and then go to law school. I decided to graduate with a degree and then go to law school. And the last year that I went, I got familiar with a bar a couple blocks away where we would park our car by the bar and come there after class and have a few. And it got to where I would stop in the bar on the way to class. And it got to where I couldn't show up to take a couple examinations because I didn't get out of the bar soon enough. And it turned out that I had to withdraw. I never finished. I lacked 20 hours to get a degree. And I don't think that was cute, and I don't think it was smart, but that's just the way that it happened for me. I was able to get good jobs, and I was always going to go back and finish. And I did have an ambition to come back there and teach, because this was mostly all guys going there to night school. And I wanted to come back and teach them. I was specializing in advertising. So I got a good job in advertising, and got married, and worked there, I don't know, seven years, I think something like that, and really looking to become president of the company one day. This was a giant advertising agency. They were number 10 in the country. They did a lot of General Motors advertising, Chevrolet, and it was exciting to me. Chevrolet got into stock car racing at that time, and I had a chance to go around and see those races, and it was exciting. But I was looking forward always to the big picture. My marriage went bad and sour, and we got a divorce, and I couldn't believe it, you know, because I believed that we should get married forever, and you know, and that was it. But it was all over, and it bothered me so much. I went, and I was drinking pretty heavy too. My lunch hour was usually a 2-hour affair, and I went to the personnel department, said I wanted to take a 1-year sabbatical. And they said why, and I told them, you know. And they said they wouldn't guarantee that I'd have a job when I come back. So I left and went down to Florida, Pompano Beach, and I got a sod and landscaping business down there. And I don't know, after doing that for about a month, going out to the sod field and getting sod, it was very hot out there, and I have to take a couple of 6-packs to keep from getting dehydrated. I come out of there one time out of the sod field, and after having those 6-packs, I had to go to the men's room, and it was a long road with nothing on it, deserted road, and I was in a hurry to get back in town and deliver my grass. That's the legal grass, by the way. I decided that I could get this done by standing on the dash, the running board. Yeah, go to the bathroom that way. And I had one hand on the steering wheel and a can of beer in my other hand. It was a straight road, but there was a big bump in it, like a rut, and I hit that, and the truck swerved and went over the bank of a ditch, a 6-foot ditch that usually in the rainy season was full of water, was dry, and the truck landed upside down. I got thrown to the bank, still had a can of beer in my hand, and I saw the truck tires going like that, and I'm saying, boy, you're such a dumb. I was so mad at myself, I couldn't, you know, stand it. How could I do something like so dumb like that? And you know, I got the tow truck come, got the truck out of there, and somebody else helped me pick up the grass, and the next day went on about my business like nothing's wrong, you know. This is not so bad. The day before, I was going to leave Florida, get the hell out. Things weren't right. Next day, everything's okay, you know. Back business as usual. So I after a year, I went back up to Detroit, and I asked for my old job back. And this guy come out and sat down with me, and he I knew who he was, but I didn't work anywhere near him or have any work connected with his. And I said, am I going to be able to get my job back? He said, well, he says, there's no guarantee on that. I said, what are you talking about? He says, I'm a member of AA, and I'd like to invite you to come to a meeting. I said, I was insulted. How could they do a thing like that to a high-class guy like me? Serious. And I said, nothing doing. I walked out. No. And I had the slightest idea or inkling that was a full 10 years before I ever did get to AA. But I thought about that a lot, you know, after I did get sober. I may not have got sober for the right reason, and I may not have stayed sober. All I know about that, it takes what it takes. So I still had 10 years to go here, and I got a job with a smaller advertising agency, and that worked out good, but that company was going bankrupt. And then I went to a little larger advertising agency that was doing a lot of work for Ford Motor Company, and believe it or not, boy, that was like falling in, you know what, and coming out smelling like a rose. There was a beautiful bar right next to the office, and so it was real convenient to get lunch there, you know, the wet variety. Whenever we would, the suppliers that we had would often take us to lunch at nice places where they served food as well, but it was, could get plenty to drink too. And the drink we called soup at that time, I remember that. Gotta have the soup along with our food. That was a heavy drinking job, it turned out. After a time, I got a chance to work at a baking company, and to be the advertising manager and sales promotion manager, public relations manager. And that's a fancy title for conducting tours of the bakery. They decided to cancel that because twice I didn't make it back from lunch to take a tour. So that simplified my job, though. You know, all I had to do was concentrate on being an advertising manager and sales manager. So that went on and on, and I got sick. I had bronchial asthma, and I was really sick with it. I wound up going to Mayo Clinic, and they saved my life there. I went up there blue one day, blue fingernails and blue lips, and very serious. But this doctor up there, he had about 12 guys on his special program. One of them was an astronaut who would never go in space because of the lung condition. But doctor, I call him Coach, he saved my life because he taught me how to take the medicine properly, how to give myself a shot in the leg with epinephrine, which is adrenaline, if I couldn't make it to the emergency, and things like that. I was becoming aware that there was some mortality connected with my life, you know. And young people don't usually think in those terms, about how serious living can be, especially if dying is connected with it. So, and I didn't think that I could die or would. And this doctor said, let me tell you something. He says, You you just don't understand, but there's a lot of asthmatics that die because they don't get their breath. And I didn't know that. I thought I was always going to get my breath. I never used to panic. But so I decided that my health was bad enough, and the bakery wanted to open up a Florida branch and sell their bread to all their retired customers from Detroit living in Florida. And I convinced them that I'd be the man. I made myself national franchise manager, because they had this mix developed, and all had to be done was add water to it, and they could make Xerox copies of that bread anywhere in the country or even the world. So they moved me lock, stock, and barrel to Florida, and after doing this for about a year, and there was a bad business economy going on, they wanted me to come back to Detroit. I didn't want to go back to Detroit. I really loved Florida. And the president of the company came and spoke to me and said, would you consider coming back? What do you want? I said, I'll come back if you make me president. I had big ideas. And the president of the company said, I'm already president. And I said, well, I've got it all figured out. We'll make you chairman of the board. So you've still got, everything's still the way it would be, because you don't like something that I want to do, you can say no. You're chairman of the board, you got no power. And she said, well, what about this other guy that's there, that's the general manager? And I said, well, you know what, we can make him vice president, but let's give him an office down the hallway, and he can take long lunch hours and do all that stuff, and it'll be all right. And I was told, you're pretty young. You're very young to be a president of the company. And I said, listen, I've been there 8 years now, and companies nowadays hire presidents right off the street. I've been there 8 years, so, you might think I'm a little wet behind the ears, but, I got some time in here. And they thanked me very much for my interest in the company and my enthusiasm, and said they were trying to get along without me. Would I please return the credit cards and the automobiles? And they would say they keep my. They said they keep. I had some more checks to receive, And at this juncture, my family decided they didn't want to stay with me anymore because there would be no more income, and I wasn't going to go back to Detroit and continue the income. So they let me know that they wanted me to continue on my own, and I thought, well, that. I couldn't understand that. Why did they want to get off the train with me? And they explained that I was too difficult to live with me because of all that was happening with my drinking and carrying on and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I got very depressed, and I drank more to make the depression go away. And it just made me more depressed. And so I went to see a psychiatrist, and I told him my sad tale of woe, and he wanted me to take Valium. And he didn't ask me anything about drinking. I said, I can't take Valium. He said, why is that? I said, I quit it. He said, why'd you quit it? I said, it made me so depressed. And he said, well, I want you to take it. And I said, I'm not taking it. And so I walked out of there. He didn't help me. And I'm not knocking psychiatrists, and I just didn't have enough time to spend, or money either. I went to a psychologist, and by this time I wanted to murder my my wife, because she wasn't, or arrange, I wanted to arrange it anyways. But it was, I was feeling guilty about having these thoughts, and I went to a psychologist though, and I said, "Can I tell you things that are between you and I, and not going to, you know, get out?" And because my wife had a way of calling doctors and finding out everything, this was before HIPAA and all, she could call up and, I don't know, and talk to the secretary or whoever, and she would find out anything she wanted to know. And so I didn't want her to find out that I wanted to knock her off. I said to this guy, "Between you and I now, this utmost confidentiality, right?" He says, "Only to the point that I think you're going to hurt yourself or somebody else, I'd have to notify the authorities." I said, "Goodbye." And I called my doctor friend at Mayo Clinic, and I said, "I got to come up there." And so I went up there, and they put me in one of those places that has a rubber room. They call it the Cackle Factory, I think, something like that. And I was there for 10 days, feeling sorry for myself. Well, they were giving me some kind of thing to take, and I couldn't cry anymore. It was unbelievable. I wanted to cry because I was so depressed and I was so upset. My life had just turned to shambles, and I couldn't even cry. It was miserable, really. And the most pleasant thought I had was maybe doing myself in, you know. It was terribly uncomfortable, all joking aside, you know. Terrible place to be. And they said they couldn't help me. And I'd been there 10 days, and they poked and prodded me and everything, and they came with a clipboard, six, you know, doctors and nurses, and wrote things down and everything, and they said, "You can't stay here, we can't help you." And I thought, if Mayo Clinic can't help me, I gotta be a really bad case. And I said, "Well, what do you recommend?" They said, "Well, we have a 28-day rehab across town, and we'd like you to go there." I said, what's that rehab?" They said, "ATU." I said, "What's ATU?" They said, "Alcohol Treatment Unit." I was insulted. How could they say this to an I-class guy like me? Well, I finally agreed to go, and the next thing I'm in a taxi cab with no door handles and no window handles. And I said to the cab driver, "Are you sure this ain't a cop car undercover?" "No, but they just want me to make sure that I get somebody from A to B." I went there in a treatment center, and after 7 days, they told me I couldn't stay there. I thought, this is really good. I said, "Why?" I said, "You know, this." It was a week or two before Christmas, and 50% of the beds were empty, and I still had some insurance at that stage that was paying the bill. I said, "I enjoy the food and the ping pong table and the pool table and enjoy the people." They said, "You can't stay here." And I said, "Why not?" They said, "You're not an alcoholic. This is an alcohol treatment center." I said, "Well, I never wanted to be an alcoholic. I'm serious." They said, "Well, that's what this place is for. You don't get it." And I said, "Well, what do I do now?" The guy says, "Go home, go to AA." And I was insulted again. But I didn't have many choices left. And I called home, and my wife says, "If they're letting you out, they got to be crazier than you are. And you're a real nutball." My wife didn't think I was an alcoholic. She said, "My father's an alcoholic. Nothing like you." So, but I talked to her and let me stay in the garage and went home. And I did what they told me. I joined AA. I got a sponsor right away. And he told me what I needed to know and what I needed to do. I joined a Fort Lauderdale men's group, the best group in the whole world at that time. And they told me I don't ever have to drink again as long as I live. Even if I want to, I still don't have to. And I listened, you know, I bought it. I did what my sponsor told me. Said they're going to teach me how to count to one. I go one freaking day without one freaking drink. And everything else is BS. Unless I can learn how to master that. Not going to have nothing, do nothing, be nothing about that. And I never drank again. I got the same sponsor today. I went to a young people's group. And, you know, I don't. Some people took me. I thought I'm maybe too old for that. And they said, no, the only requirement is to be under 100. Well, now I'm 40 years closer to that. Time's running out. I love AA. I got it so good, I had to kiss the floor every time I walked through the door. I've been to AA all over the country whenever I travel, out of the country when I travel, 14 times to Hawaii. I never thought I'd have a chance to travel outside the country, go to Europe. Went to Europe first class. AA paid for that. Unbelievable. But I'm going to keep coming for the rest of my life. If there's anybody here that don't have the best group in the whole world like I have, keep looking until you find it, because that has a lot to do with getting sober and staying sober. Thank you very much.